Hello, and welcome again to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshinworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. First, let's welcome my co-host, Dr. Vikram Shyam. Vic, welcome.
Hey, I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for about 15 years. I'm currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, also known as CAS. And our interest is to look forward 50 plus years and use strategic foresight to uncover societal problems and see where we as aviation and the broader aerospace community can have the broadest possible impact on the largest number of people, and to make sure that our society is more resilient, more people are doing well in the future. Back to you, Diane.
Excellent. Thanks, Vic. And as I mentioned, we're thrilled and honored to welcome Dr. Ali Husseini, Research Fellow with the King's College in London and Principal Investigator, Health and Social Equity Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology, and Neuroscience. Ali, welcome.
Thanks very much, Diane, and thanks, Vic, for having me here. That's a great introduction. I work in engineering and also some of the healthcare and social sciences side of that. So basically, my goal in engineering and also the arts where I'm active is using principles from all these disciplines to create a more just and humane society. And clearly, we need to do that through engineering. We pretty much live in engineered environments now. So we can't just count on nature to step up to the plate and save us from ourselves, as it were, but also to create a better human environment where we thrive. So that's my goal in everything I do, is humane, sustainable environments where people can thrive and where diversity flourishes.
Love that. You have such a unique background and portfolio of work, Ali. I'm really looking forward to diving into this. I read a quote somewhere that the New York Times describes you as a biochemist turned philosopher turned television producer turned visual poet. I think that the nature of that multidisciplinary approach and view on kind of society and how we integrate all of these incredible advanced technologies, the potential benefit is amazing as we roll innovation and advanced technologies out into industry, into society, but maintaining the human experience, right? And the benefits of all of these innovations is it takes some design work and takes some kind of appreciation of kind of the human experience. So how do you explain the work that you're doing and how you're bringing all of these kind of multidisciplinary lenses to kind of the portfolio of work in which you're invested today?
Well, I'd say that the outermost explanation is curiosity, but there's also an ethical compass to what I do, which is looking at how we as a species have brought our own world to the point of catastrophe. And I think the life world, one way or another, will go on, but the human species may find itself in more and more uncomfortable situations. We already are with climate change that's going on and the global heat waves and the flooding and the loss of the ice caps. And I think years ago, I sat there and I thought, and I was meeting people who are very intelligent and also very ethical, yet involved in overall activities which you could say are harmful. And I include myself in that too. If you look at my career, there are things I thought maybe were good at the time or that we were doing good things, but turned out to be harmful, or at least started a kind of oscillation in society. So every time I've looked at one of these twists that happens, an unexpected disruptive change that is truly disruptive, I mean, there's good disruption where you have innovation and you have opening of new markets and you have new economies, which expand prosperity, but you also have other kinds of disruption, which bring harm and catastrophe to people. So I thought, well, how can we understand these? And through understanding them, how can we avoid that? So I kept changing disciplines to gain a new perspective onto what you might call, in two words, a wicked problem.
Vic, I'm sure appreciate that perspective and the work that you guys are doing on the wicked problem landscape, Vic, in the NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. You're bringing a lot of that multidisciplinary kind of work and collaboration into the work that the teams are leading as well. Your thoughts regarding how we, as a society, bring storytelling, plenary approach into kind of systems design and integrating the innovation and the change that's rolling through society and industry today. What are some of the best practices or considerations in kind of bringing that multidisciplinary approach to wicked problem resolution?
Is that for me, Diane?
It is. Yes.
Sure. That's a complicated question about complex problems. So I don't know if there are best practices, partly because I know there's plenty of case studies and I know there's many people that consult in this field, but if we were to take a humble approach to all of this stuff, we've only been practicing these kinds of techniques for maybe a few hundred years. I'm being generous. And if you look at natural systems and the experiments that have been going on in natural ecosystems, there have been millions of iterations over billions of years. And so to assume that we know the best practices is, well, they may be a little arrogant. So I would say that perhaps the best thing we can do is to, one, learn from history. So try to learn the lessons from everything that's come before, including successful practices from ecosystems, such as, let's say, rainforests or grasslands and things like that, more generally, but then also start to look at your systems thinking and start to piece together how information is flowing and try to create analogies to the organizations that we've set up to see how can we successfully set up feedback loops and use the leverage points that are available. And very often this involves listening or engaging the community because we've established these silos, we've been growing in silos. So I think one of the best things we can do is to start creating network of networks to try and engage as many people as possible, listen to as many people as possible, and then bring them in early on and throughout the life cycle of formulating the problem, understanding it, and then proposing solutions. So I spoke a lot, but generally it's learning from history, learning from everyone around us, and then maintaining the sense of humility, knowing that we don't yet have the best approach and just having a learning mentality.
Yeah. Ali, your thoughts? I know you've given a lot of thought to autocatalytic systems, learning systems as well. Your thoughts on this?
Well, before I dive into that, I'd just like to pick up on Vic's point about learning from history. It is astonishing to see how people's views of nature changed. Not too long ago, as in just a few centuries, forests were huge, terrifying places, and they were best just left alone or avoided, actually, or torn down and used for wood and used as a resource and replaced with farmland. People began to change their attitude towards forests earlier than some of the other natural products of the or services of the ecosystem, like swamps. And very recently, and we still say drain the swamp, people thought swamps and wetlands were something to be avoided, something to be drained, something to be eliminated. And now we realize how mistaken we were on both of those counts. And we could put that in other terms too, with antibacterial soaps. Bacteria were something to be avoided. We didn't realize that all of these natural entities, both as individuals like trees and then forests, or as all the components of marshland, uncomfortably wet and smelly water that's full of all kinds of living things that we might find be squeamish about. And finally, bacteria, which we saw as invasive, produce very strong benefits for humanity. So we absolutely have to approach nature with humility and also to realize not only that we've made mistakes in history, but that we're still historically bound, and we're still probably full of prejudices about nature and what nature does to sustain us. So we need to move very gingerly on these topics.
Yeah, no, I do agree. And when we were chatting prior to our conversation today, we talked some about business versus biological ecosystems and how these natural ecosystems, the systems in nature, offer just a multitude of basically lesson landscapes for us, right? If we approach them with humility, with curiosity, there are a lot of lessons that can be taken and applied to the way business ecosystems are beginning to form and interact. And would love your thoughts, maybe help us with maybe a deeper understanding of how biology can, actually for both of you, biology can perhaps enhance our approach to market making and market relationships and sustainable market relationships. Thoughts there?
Yeah, actually, before you go, Ellie, you mentioned the swamps and our aversion to them. I guess where I live now, so Norfolk area and Virginia, the namely swampland around that we've built all these cities on it. We learned to use it, and there's now hikes and trails, and people actually go out there to enjoy themselves. A big shift in mindset.
Yeah, Seashore State Park. I used to go there when I was a kid. Well, thank you, Diane, for mentioning the question about ecosystems and the difference between business and organic ecosystems. And the first thing I want to say, approaching this in the spirit of humility, which we have already established, is that these are big questions and big issues, and they're hardly settled. There's a lot of discussion going on. There's a lot of controversy. I'm in the middle of some of that controversy. And really, all the answers that we have are provisional. So I'm going to say things that maybe come out as statements, but do think that we need to refine them. And if anything can come out of this conversation, I hope for both you and your audience that there is an invitation to explore and participate in addressing these questions. I won't say we'll ever solve them. The processes may go on, but we'll get better at them. We'll be iterative, as Vic pointed out, over, well, we don't have millions of years yet, but iteration and being able to learn from experience is important. That said, I think we can look at some big differences between engineered or organic ecosystems. And the big one is that the ecosystem at large is the global environment. Now, all the business ecosystems are actually part of that global environment. So that gets to a point that I think we all pretty much agree on, although there are many politicians and social movements that don't, which is that we need to have sustainable industry. But for this discussion, let's assume that's established. So what are some of the differences? Well, a lot of engineered systems are extractive, whereas organic ecosystems are productive. So what's the difference between being just extractive and productive? For one thing, a lot of the extraction that's going on is disrupting the conditions for life or the perpetuation of the global environment. So that's problematic. But it's also interesting on a theoretical level to think, well, life is so efficient at how it uses resources. In fact, engineering creates waste, but organic systems, engineering ecosystems create waste, but organic ecosystems create utility. So that's a fundamental lesson that we can draw from a difference, which is that, and maybe this can even feed into some of the design thinking that we're doing, which I think is actually a really powerful way of addressing this, is that we want to always create utility at every stage. And that gets back to thinking about trees or forests and swamps and marshes. They provide ecosystem services. So maybe some of our future business ecosystems, if not providing fresh air and filtered water and protection from storms, at least don't create waste, but create utility at every step. So they're actually being, if not self-organized, at least not wasteful and not creating a lot of slurry that can't be used for anything and that undermines their own foundation. So in a sense, a lot of business ecosystems undermine the conditions for their own possibility, whereas organic systems are always perpetuating the conditions for their own possibility.
So I guess, how do we know when we've done a good job, or are there people who are successfully using these practices? Are you familiar with any organizational case studies, maybe in the UK or elsewhere?
I can't give you a case study that I think is completely successful, but there are a lot of movements which are. There are movements like the New European Bauhaus There are a lot of sustainability movements and just sustainable architecture, possibly using wood-based architecture and reusing the remnants of old buildings and industrial infrastructure. I think anybody who does brownfield development is definitely moving ahead and moving ahead in terms of, say, greenfield development. So when we start to reuse, recycle, and repurpose, overall, there's a huge social movement towards this. And I think these practices are being adopted widely, but in a dispersed way. So I wouldn't name institutions per se that are doing it, but moving towards zero waste or zero carbon is certainly a beneficial goal. But more generally, I think you can judge, I can give you some criteria for judging that. A lot of our engineering has been linear in terms of extraction and then waste disposal. When organizations start to become cyclical and not produce waste, but actually produce their own resources, which they use again and again, we're definitely moving in the right direction. And I think having plastics that are actually recyclable are useful. The use of cornstarch, either breaking down back into the environment or being able to be reused again in another product, is a powerful movement. Overall, I'd say you want to look at it and measure it in terms of entropy. A lot of our engineering is entropic, but ultimately it runs down and produces disorder. And organic systems are anti-entropic. In other words, they produce order. They absorb, they're open systems because they absorb energy from the sun. Ultimately, that's what there's also a lot of chemical energy in the earth. So those are the kinds of things that we want to start designing for, are systems that are self-sustaining and self-organizing.
That makes sense. And yeah, you started to talk about energy and the resources. So yeah, a lot of our systems, we operate under the same constraints, right? So we have the energy of the sun, but at the same time, we're limited in terms of we want to use less energy, we want to use less materials, try to use as much water-based stuff as possible. These are all things that are beneficial, not just to the natural environment, but to us as well. And so in doing this, very often the barrier is the people who are in, let's say, engineering or science, or let's say even organizational development, the architects, they don't have the biological and the natural background to look at, here's all the stuff that's come before us. I think one of the big things I'm observing is the role of AI, large language models specifically, and you know, in bringing that kind of knowledge to everyone's desk and allowing them to start saying, okay, how might I redesign my office space? How might I create a policy that's more equitable? And so I guess, what are some use cases that you're maybe seeing that are leveraging AI for this? And then I want to flip it around and say, artificial intelligence, inherently, there's like a natural inspiration element to it because it's trying to mimic how thinking happens. And so what are some efforts going on to harness natural systems or that kind of thinking in development of AI?
Well, the first part is how is AI being applied in creativity, I guess you would say. And I have a cautionary note about AI, because AI essentially is learning what's already come out of human culture. So it reproduces our biases. It's not essentially creative, I would argue, and it can actually be subject to big problems such as catastrophic forgetting, and as I said, the replication of biases. And in fact, there are some contradictions, which I've even read mathematically proven, between things like equity and justice, because we have really different ideas. So when we start to move into AI, there are two issues there. One is biology and sustainability, and the other is value-based engineering. And both of those start to move into a domain which is very ambiguous, and AI isn't particularly good at dealing with ambiguities. And the other part is that they can lead to systems which, instead of being virtuous circles or wicked problems or negative death spirals. So I think architecture is probably, an urban design, are probably the most powerful use cases for AI. And I see more and more coming out in medicine, where at least the routine parts of medicine can be automated, and that frees up humans to exercise their judgment and to actually refine their judgment. So I think AI is always going to be augmenting what we can do, at least insofar as it's currently based or currently practiced or developed, and it can free up energy, time, and space for people to exercise judgment in terms of diagnosing things and also creativity in terms of finding new uses for things. I think where AI is going to fall short is on the really fundamental creation of new product lines and new ways of thinking. Creativity in the organic world comes down to finding new affordances and co-creating the environment. And you see a lot of co-creation, say, in business ecosystems. And probably the earliest example of this is where farmers grow wheat, bakers or mills the wheat and sells it to a baker. And then a baker makes bread, which then lets the farmers sustain themselves and have more farmers. So you have this expansion of the economy going on through what's called an autocatalytic set. In other words, the products of the set or these entities are creating the conditions for their own existence and their own expansion. And you could look at, say, the growth of the personal computer in similar terms between hardware, software, marketing, and utility. So these are the kinds of situations where AI can be applied to actually accelerating the adoption of technologies which are very labor intensive and require a lot of routine decision making. So if you think about it, say, in the legal realm, probably more and more legal research is being conducted by LLMs where they're finding precedents. But those still need to go and be analyzed by someone who has the judgment to say, this is going to make a good argument in court, and be able to infuse both the values and the emotions which express those values into court. I think this is another case where creative R&D is quite useful. So I think in the arts, AI is very interesting in terms of enabling artists to do things they haven't done before, but also enabling artists to work together with engineers, whether it's in 5G, 6G, or other kinds of systems, urban management, circulation management, whether it's in a building, a museum, or a city, or regional transportation networks. So you're able to run through things like combinatorics, all the different combinations and permutations of things in a very quick way with AI that you couldn't do with an unaided human brain, or for that matter, even an advanced traditional computer.
Yeah, I love that possibility of combinatorics and how we might be able to augment a kind of that creative process and the learning process with some of these technologies, but to do so systemically is still a little bit ahead of us. I think we would all argue. I saw, Ali, when we were kind of beginning to prepare for this conversation, you had a really brilliant use case on your site. It showcased this use case that was made possible through, I think, some of the deep work that's being done in 5G and the advanced technologies, where a surgeon was using a haptic glove in order to perform a procedure, and that data was dropped into a database and then fed and could be fed into an exoskeleton that could then be used to train any number of students in any number of situations, right? Remote training for very advanced types of caregiving and skills development, and this concept of really the internet of skills. So how can we, to your point, how can we accelerate the establishment of these conditions whereby we are able to create these autocatalytic systems, right? The implementation of use cases and environments where we can accelerate learning, we can accelerate beneficial use cases and deployment of these technologies and innovations so that we can advance kind of the human experience and learning and economic development. It seems like the components are there, but we're not deploying them systemically where the benefits are being unlocked really at scale or at speed.
Well, I think to your point about internet of skills, that's where AI actually could be very valuable, because it can absorb those skills and it can reproduce them in a sophisticated way that's deployed across networks, and particularly into places that are deprived, let's say, of teachers or say skilled surgeons who can do it on the spot. So if you can put your hand into a glove, you could learn the piano, or you could learn to conduct surgery with guidance that's augmented by AI and machine learning to produce a near perfect result, or to produce different techniques depending on who's trained it. To the question about how we can actually produce better design processes, I think you're off to a good start with the design thinking that you mentioned earlier, which is to look at problem solving and indeed invention in terms of design thinking, which means iterative processes that don't presuppose solutions, but that have goals, and bringing together multidisciplinary teams. So actually starting with the multidisciplinary approach, I think we can have a few principles that we lay out for ecosystem design and ecosystem development that you were asking about. One is bring in different disciplines, bring in different perspectives, including sociology and the arts, along with engineering. And I've harped on the Renaissance, and maybe there are other words that would be, feel more contemporary for it, but Renaissance really gets to this notion of people who are either upskilled and trained in multiple disciplines or work very closely on equal level with people from different disciplines. So you bring in these different perspectives, because one disciplinary perspective is too reductionist for others. And there's a saying that artists are good at creativity, but they're not so good at innovation. And engineers are good at innovation, but they're not very creative. And that's a bit of a truism, but there's some truth to that, I think. Bringing in these two different approaches can not only help develop new products, but also let us develop standards for those new products to be deployed and start to give us models and scenarios for testing those. You brought up surgery. This is a really important use case, but it's pretty hard to practice it. So what we were developing standards for 5G, which was at King's College London and the Center for Telecommunications Research and Ericsson, a partnership several years ago that I was part of. We had three use cases. We had transportation, we had medicine, telemedicine in this case, and the arts. And it turned out that it was safest to test the human tolerances with the arts. When you have two musicians collaborating together over distance, they're very sensitive to actually time differences that are measured in milliseconds. So we found that we could test network jitter and other faults and see what the human tolerance was, and the perceptual tolerance, the perceptual thresholds, using the arts rather than a scenario that is much more dangerous, such as controlling a surgical robot or rolling through a transportation system. I think we're mostly working with Transport for London, which has buses and trains, but the same applies for airplanes and any other high-risk scenario. So that's where multidisciplinary design thinking can work. I think I also mentioned some of the other principles, which are to look at the environment and see what are the affordances here. And by affordances, I mean, are there things that are being treated as waste that could be a supply stream for your product? And starting the invention from that, saying, well, there's this huge resource here. We're actually creating and burying or burning, even worse. Is there some way to extract value from that? Which is the way a natural process works. It's a very different faculty than cognition. I mean, we tend to do things through thought. Natural systems evolve through agency, what's called biological agency or biological autonomy, another subject, which makes these two, the technosphere and the biosphere, quite different. But we can still start to import some of the best practices, you might say, of the biosphere into the technosphere, which are iterative thinking, multi-perspectival process, which means there are a lot of different agents working on everything from the big things that we see, like humans and tigers and trees, down to bacteria and viruses and even prions and other vectors, which we're just now beginning to learn about.
From, I guess, the why and the what we're doing, maybe we can jump a bit to some of the mechanics or the foundation. One of the things you talked about before we started, this was phase spaces. And I wonder if you could maybe explain what exactly you mean by phase spaces and what does that mean in the context of biological systems. We use phase spaces in physics and mathematics and such when we're talking about like Hilbert space and things like that. But what exactly does it mean in a biological context?
Well, the reason some sound came up. The reason Phase spaces are important for biology is because they don't apply, strictly speaking, to biological phenomena. So a phase space in physics would be a place where all of the equations that describe a particular phenomenon or vector are valid. So you have valid solutions at any point in that phase space. So you can take an object and put it on a vector or trajectory or geodetic and know that you're going to get an answer that's valid when you're working within that particular phase space. With biology, we can't apply this same system, although we keep trying. And another place where phase spaces are applied pretty unsuccessfully is the economy. And the economy may, in fact, be governed by similar principles. And to put it in really bold in terms and simple terms, it is that biology and probably the economy too, which then touches onto business, is an evolutionary space. And evolution is inherently unpredictable. And it's unpredictable because you can't put a biological object onto a vector and expect that it's going to end up in the same place where it starts. Biological entities are always multiplying and dividing. And every time they do, as we know from Darwin, we have descent with modification. So they're mutating, in other words. And some mutations are harmful. Most of them probably are. Some are beneficial. And you have this kind of complexity going. But it's not just ordinary or physical complexity or what we call emergence in dissipative systems or in chemistry more fundamentally. You have self-organization, and a category that in this theory of biology I'm working on is called biological autonomy. So you have biological systems and entities working as agents, and these agents are always looking for new affordances. If you think about the evolution of lungs, they started as a swim bladder for fish just to stay at a particular level within a body of water or change levels and stay static wherever there's food. And eventually those, over many iterations and many millions of years, became lungs, which then created a whole new affordance for Mesozoa, the sort of larger animals. The land had been colonized by bacteria and algae and maybe fungi and things like that. But larger animals couldn't go until they had some way of processing oxygen and other nutrients or other vital substances out of the air. So that's an example of a new phase space being created. And it happens all the time. We see it with bacteria and even COVID constantly. And that's our viruses are liminal, i.e. marginal, not quite alive, but they use lifelike strategies in terms of adaptation. So they're adaptive systems. And you might put something in that initially kills the pathogen, but eventually the pathogen learns to feed on it, which is the exact opposite result that you want, or at least thrive in that environment or find another vulnerability. So that's where you can't or propose a phase space for biology, because biology is always going through what's called a critical transition from one phase space to another. I don't want to get too technical here, but hopefully that clarifies what you're asking, Vic. Do you want me to go into more detail on Sartre's?
No, I think that was a good example. I was just thinking about something related to that, where there's a nice book called The Vertebrate Integument, which it's about how our skin and all of that developed over time in vertebrates, and our bones and our even the armored fish and stuff. The original purpose of that was to store minerals. And then later on, it ends up being an evolutionary advantage and then ends up being our vertebrate. So, yeah, lots of these, I guess they're called exaptations, perhaps, where one thing is used for something else and then you can repurpose it. A lot of architectural terms. Diane, any thoughts?
Yeah, I keep coming back to the parallels between, and this is just my area of interest, the parallels between biological ecosystems and really business ecosystems or social ecosystems, and how perhaps creative evolution in maybe ecosystemic policy or ecosystemic design can learn from the history of these natural systems, right? So listening to you both, are there lessons implicit or businesses or public institutions to maybe evolve the way that they create governance systems or frameworks for interaction that are more beneficial, right? that reduce the waste in a system and increase the regenerative nature of those models. And I'll just, that's very broad in its scope, but I would love your thoughts, Allie, on how we might be able to create more intentional and kind of scalable frameworks for creative evolution in ecosystemic design or policy.
Well, let's look at it in the broadest picture. We have biological ecosystems, which have persisted for billions of years, and they've gradually become more complex over those billions of years. Although I don't want to downplay the complexity of a bacterium, because in many ways, it performs all the same functions as a human being and far more efficiently. But we have more and more entities, and they're interacting in more and more complicated ways. So what is that? How's that translate into the business environment? Well, we want our business environment to become more complex because we want more affordances. We want to have more opportunities, and that's a kind of complexity. So what do they have in common? We're looking for growth. The organic systems are always growing. The life world is always pushing into new phenomena, new realms. I mean, it could be that there's life even 50 kilometers down. It's explored. We definitely found life in places we didn't expect to find it, thriving down at the bottom of the Mariana Trench and other places. So these are life forms of life which are quite different to the way that we draw energy from the biosphere. Rather, they're not solar-based. They're based on chemical energy from the Earth. So there's probably even some that take out radioisotopes and radioactive decay. So there's a real creativity there in terms of the resource. And all of it is oriented towards growth. And we want economic growth, too. And I think where the two really come together are that our economic growth has come at the expense of ecological services. So as a boundary line or a boundary case, it is that we have to not expend or overexploit our ecological services. Most of them are renewable, so we need to treat them as renewable, which means letting them regenerate. And there are a lot of principles for that. But I think that also looking at the positive side of growth here, we could say that the ecosystem has grown because in complexity and scope and scale, because it has many different agents and they're all stakeholders in it. And one of the things that companies and people have traditionally done is kept secrets and not worked with other stakeholders too well. And then they tried to dominate a particular sector or a particular market. And now we've discovered that actually the markets are interlinked and companies need to cooperate as much as compete. And you actually need both mutualism and competition. And there's some applications of autocatalytic sets that I could direct people to later if they want. They're looking at some of the fundamental questions of economics and whether they're mutualist or cooperative or competition is at the heart of it. And Schipperter's point on creative destruction is well taken, but there's also just creative creation too, which is equally important. And I think what we can learn from nature is that there is competition. It's red in tooth and claw for sure, but there's a lot of cooperation. In fact, we couldn't digest food without the trillions of microorganisms that live in our gut. So we're having this new appreciation now that even our skin is providing an environment for certain kinds of bacteria and other protozoa that live. Something lives in the crook of your elbow and something else is on the back of your knuckle, and one twist of your gut has a microbiome and another has another one, and they're all working cooperatively to keep us alive. So I think having this multi-agent approach is very important. So, and that can come both in the way that we start to innovate and also regulate, because we made the point, and I think Vic and I have both made this point, that we have adaptive systems going on in evolution. And there's this adaptation from, say, mineral storage to ossification, and all of a sudden you can walk upright and you can create a much larger organism. The combination, actually, of, say, vertebrae and lungs, because you can't count on diffusion or the way that insects absorb oxygen from the atmosphere anymore. You need lungs to have a creature that's large enough to have vertebrae. So it all fits together. And if we can start to, through design thinking, which means not pre-planning, but to iterative adjustments to our initial designs with multi-agent, multi-stakeholder investment in that whole design process. And I think we can create more sustainable products and markets that also grow in the way that we need them to grow. We absolutely need economic growth. We're all going to count on economic growth to pay for our retirements, because now we have these extra long lives because of the success of hygiene and medicine, and now with the introduction of AI and a certain elements of biomedicine, we're going to live more long, and we might not be working the whole time. So we need to increase productivity. So if we bring in all the stakeholders, I feel confident that we can create business ecosystems that start to mirror the kind of efficiency, but also the effectiveness and ultimately the value in the ethical sense, as well as the economic sense, that the biosphere produces for us.
So there are a lot of interesting points, Ali. So you mentioned the mutualism, maintaining productivity. So all these new kinds of the products that would be entering this ecosystem. But we as humans, we're not going to stop everything we're doing. There's all these people that are working. They haven't already cooperated. We have these systems that are being developed. There are, for example, there's projects that are trying to integrate the smart grid and use AI to run and try to figure out where the electricity goes, who gets the credit for what. There's autonomous vehicles coming online, and there might be an AI that's governing that system. There's going to be AI governing individual businesses. We all have some kind of AI interaction in our homes. We haven't all agreed on what's ethical. We haven't all agreed on one policy set, but all these things are coming online. So when you talk about these autocratic sets, it's almost like, are these AI agents going to be deciding what emerges in the future? Do we have any control over that? And then shouldn't we be looking at how to improve AI using these biological systems as a starting point? Our AI is, right now we're talking about things like neural networks and GANs, and it's not really mimicking how an actual brain works or how an ecosystem works. It's still kind of primitive, right?
I agree that AI could benefit from a lot of different biological models, starting with truly neuromorphic computing, and there are movements to do that. But our brain is extraordinarily efficient and produces a lot of value with a very low amount of energy. And that's partly because it's efficient in its material organization. So you have what we call brain waves, but they're really oscillations going on. They're not individual signals. There are other, actually, gamma waves modulate alpha and beta. You've got all kinds of temporal framing going on in the brain that we have yet to exploit in a computing environment. So starting to look at how to design a material system that mimics the way a brain works would be a good place to start. We could start to say, well, actually, we can work on ionic transfers and embedded neural systems rather than electricity flowing through circuits. So the first start is to lose the idea of a circuit and say, well, the whole organism is, in a sense, calculating it through ion channels. And a lot of the things that we think make neurons so different from the rest of our body actually aren't as unique as we thought, that the ion channels that you find in neurons are used throughout nature, including things that we think of as really primitive, but they're actually quite effective at evading us, like biofilms. So when bacteria can work independently, but they also cluster together when they're threatened and form a biofilm, and that's a major medical problem right now. So when we look at AI, I think what we can start to do is say that we don't necessarily need it to be thinking in a way that we have defined rationality since the time of Plato as an algorithm. Instead, it can be an embedded system that has goals, to work for those goals by learning from the environment and actually embodying that learning in its body. There's some studies about embedded neural networks done decades ago, where they took these robots and put a neural network, and very primitive one compared to what we have now, and had them just learn how to find their way in their environment. And they never formed a map of it, but they learned how to move around because the synaptic, the postsynaptic connections were coupled structurally to the body of these little robots, which were just, they were just on wheels, actually, and they would knock into things, but their field of vision was limited. So they had to learn new ways of moving around that were not based on any kind of mental or cognitive map. And we're always looking for cognitive maps, but a lot of what we call cognition actually happens on an embodied level. So I would say that would be the way to start to develop AI in a more biomorphic way, is to start with embodying the systems and embedding them into actual physical, cyber-physical systems and letting them do the learning there rather than learning from texts. And actually that, I'll go off on another point here, which is that we're really reaching the limit of how much a large language model can learn, because now at this point they're absorbing virtually everything off the internet, at least everything in English. And so we're starting to train them in different languages, but their bounds are getting limited. And there's a movement to create synthetic data to train AI on. But so far, those have not been that successful. AI trained on its own synthetic data just starts to spew garbage. In a few generations, there's the ACM Journal has an article about that. They haven't tried training AI or information by other AIs. But if we start to look at the whole world as a use case and embedding systems naively into the world, into naive robots that are limited or naive cyber-physical systems, then there's a whole different kind of learning that can happen that would start to possibly mimic or emulate or have the efficiencies that a living organism has.
Yeah, we have seen some of that work, and no doubt we'll continue to, as we start to or continue to test the boundaries of what's possible, I think we'll continue to learn what works and what doesn't. But Ali, we're going to have to kind of wrap it up from there. Honestly, could continue chatting with you for hours more. But for our listeners who are interested in learning more about kind of these principles of kind of multidisciplinary and autocatalytic systems and kind of the frames that you apply to innovation and advanced technologies, what are some of the sources that you might recommend, just as we close up, sources that you might recommend for our listeners to kind of keep in touch with your work and sources that you go to for inspiration in your exploration of these principles, but then also a couple of key takeaways that you would suggest for our listeners as we kind of wrap things up from here?
Sure. In terms of resources, I would look at the work of Lynn Margulis and James Lovelock, going all the way back to the Gaia hypothesis, and especially the introductions to different editions are quite telling. Stuart Kaufman, originally the Santa Fe Institute, has traveled around. His books are very accessible and also very profound. Investigations, I think, would be a great introduction. Dennis Noble in the UK has written a book, The Music of Life, which I think is an excellent resource. Ana Soto and Carlos Sonnenschein have written about cancer and what they call tissue organization field theory. I think those are great antidotes towards some of the received wisdom on genetics and the causes of oncogenesis and cancer being such a huge social problem. And then getting into the takeaways, I think the biggest takeaway is we need to look at both development and regulation from the standpoint of adaptation. We are creating systems that are adaptive and that are changing their behavior. So we need to change oversight and compliance to be something that happens continuously. You might even say that we could have in parallel with the continuous innovation that's going on in many companies now, that's a term of art, continuous regulation, so that regulators are gathering data points and able to, if not anticipate, at least respond very quickly to new behaviors exhibited by engineered systems. And this really matters in transportation, because we want transportation to be predictable and reliable. And things are working pretty well so far, but I sense a real fragility happening with the many hundreds of millions of lines of code, some of which are legacy and basically black boxed that run a lot of aeronautic systems, the introduction of AI systems or machine learning that would have behavioral changes, including catastrophic forgetting, which is definitely not something you want to happen in anywhere in the transportation network. And finally, having people who in the policy officers who are well-informed enough to put these policies into place so that we can have the benefits of growth, innovation, rapid introduction, rapid prototyping, rapid taking things rapidly to market, but also have oversight, compliance, and ultimately governance so that we maintain the kind of safety that we expect from 21st century engineering. We've had a great record, say, in aeronautics since the Wright brothers. It's extraordinary, actually, how safe flying is and other forms of transportation and medicine. So we need to adapt to the adaptive systems that are being introduced into all of these domains.
Wouldn't agree with you more. I've been a big advocate of policy innovation. All right. And the folks that are really have charged with governance and policy should be right up there on the innovation front with the innovators, right? Thinking about kind of the massive unlock that is possible and how the systems come together and interrelate and how they might be able to create the beneficial policy overlays so that the benefits of the innovation and advanced technologies are accessible, but the harmful or unintended consequences, there are safeguards in place. But I think you need those folks who are charged with policy right up in that the innovation trenches with the entrepreneurs and the researchers and the scientists and the system designers. So I'm with you there and grateful, Allie, for your time here today and your perspective and frankly for the work that you're leading. We're grateful for you and your work and look forward to keeping in touch. So thank you very much. And for our listeners today, thank you for joining us. This has been an incredible conversation, and we hope that you will follow Allie and his work from here. And please do, if you enjoyed this conversation, please do check us out as we introduce additional conversations with some of the world's leading minds like Allie here. And you can find our podcast episodes in all of your favorite podcast sources and, of course, always on socialworks.com. Allie, thank you again.
Thank you very much, Diane and Vic, for having me. And thanks to SocialWorks and NASA's Convergent Aeronautics program as well. So it's been an honor to talk with you.
Great.